This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The EPA is clearly taking advantage of the coronavirus pandemic to give polluters a break.
The Republican habit of putting wolves in charge of our nation's henhouses hits those who love the environment particularly hard. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with journalist Jeremy Miller about how the current EPA and Department of Interior are taking advantage of our current lockdown, working with big business and right-wing think tanks to roll back environmental protections. We discuss efforts to continue drilling on fragile lands despite plummeting oil prices, look at the uranium mining industry and its voracious thirst for water, and examine efforts by ranchers to deforest some of the West's hidden gems. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeremy Miller. Jeremy is an author and freelance journalist, and he has a new piece in The Guardian entitled Trump Seizes on Pandemic to Speed Up Opening of Public Lands to Industry. Jeremy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
We've spoken many times over the years for our listeners, and a lot of the issues that we've discussed, whether it be water or forestry, wildfires, these are all coming to the forefront right now as this pandemic seems to be an opportunity for industry to try to pull back a lot of the environmental protections that have been put in place over the last few decades. Why don't you first give us an overview of how things have changed just in the last couple of months?
I think the first thing that we need to look at is how Trump administration is opportunistic. And in this case, the coronavirus pandemic has presented an opportunity for the administration to really aggressively and sort of under the cover of the national news about the pandemic to go after key environmental laws and pursue its wish list of deregulatory opportunities when it comes to public lands, environmental protection, endangered species, and things like that.
So let's go into some more detail in some of the areas. Let's focus on the West, because it seems like that's where a lot of these issues have come to the forefront. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. This is where, you know, most of the oil and gas extraction happens, where the mining, the logging industry happens. So the rollbacks seem to be following sort of a playbook put forth by the Heritage Foundation, which released a report last month calling for the curtailing and elimination of environmental rules and oversight. So, for example, one of the efforts has been to, you know, while people have been kept off the public lands, the oil and gas industry has been allowed to have free rein. And so the oil and gas leasing programs have not been scaled back in any way. And the irony of this is that the price of oil has dropped precipitously. A couple of weeks ago, the price of a barrel of oil dropped into negative territory for the first time in history. And yet these oil and gas leases on public lands are going ahead as planned. You know, so there's sort of a disconnect there between economics and reality and sort of the wishes of the oil and gas industry. So, you know, all you can really attribute that to is this effort to give industry free rein on public lands.
Yes, you quote noted climate activist author Bill McKibben, who's been on the show several times in your piece, and let me just read it. McKibben says, "The idea that it would be critical work to speed up oil production on public lands while the planet drowns in oil tells you all you'd ever want to know about the corruption, both intellectual and actual, of the Trump administration."
That's a fair summation of what's going on. You know, the most controversial leasing effort is being undertaken by the Bureau of Land Management in Utah, where they're leasing parcels that are within a half a mile of Arches National Park, within a mile and a half of Canyonlands. So not only is the economic impetus not there to drill, but the push to drill is happening in these iconic, beautiful public lands. So that makes it especially perverse. You know, not only do we not need the oil right now, but we're looking to sacrifice our natural heritage here, our some of our most beautiful and stunning red rock landscapes to oil and gas at a time when we don't need it.
When we talk about Bill McKibben, it's hard to not think about the fight he's been at the forefront of when it comes to blocking the Keystone XL pipeline. And then you also have like the Dakota Access Pipeline. We had Candy Mossett, who is an indigenous environmental activist, on 3 years ago talking about the struggles that her community is having in trying to fend off big oil interests in places like Standing Rock and Bear's Ears. And you note that as these national parks are being closed to tourists, big oil seems to be getting their clutches. Some of the licenses that they're looking for are right next to some of these very fragile and sacred lands.
Exactly. Yeah. So just as oil companies have attempted to ram through these big pipelines that you mentioned, Keystone, XL, being the big one, they've also looked to try to tap into uranium deposits on the edge of Grand Canyon National Park and Bears Ears National Monument, which is sacred landscape to indigenous peoples of southern Utah. And the fact that there aren't any visitors on the ground right now, so few tourists sort of looking at these landscapes and being out there and appreciating them is sort of emboldening, I think, extractive industry to get in there and try to tap into these uranium deposits that have been denied to them for a long time. And the people of the Navajo Nation have suffered for decades with impacts from uranium mining. And the idea that the pandemic right now is being used as a chance to ramp up this kind of mining is just unconscionable, I think. It's just but another example of how the Trump administration is trying to leverage this crisis to have their way with our public lands and with these resources.
Let's talk about the EPA itself. It's obviously gone under some serious changes over the last 5 years. Andrew Wheeler is the current EPA administrator who took over from Scott Pruitt, who a lot of people remember being a pretty bad guy, to say the least. But Andrew Wheeler is a former coal industry executive, and in many ways, though, he's the fox guarding the hen house. Gina McCarthy, who's the former head of the EPA and now president of the NRDC. What did she have to say about how the EPA is taking a turn since she's left?
So what's going on is that Andrew Wheeler, who, like, as you mentioned, replaced Scott Pruitt, but who also happens to be a former coal lobbyist, decided that they were going to shut down all enforcement and monitoring of the nation's polluters. So from oil refineries, small manufacturers, they came out and announced that the COVID-19 crisis was demanded that the EPA stop oversight of our nation's air and water. And basically, the quote here is that he said that they were going to be diverting staff time to respond to individual questions about routine monitoring reporting requirements would hinder the EPA's ability to focus on continued protection of human health and the environment. Which is just, another invitation for polluters to do what they want and under the cover of this pandemic.
Yeah, break that down a little bit more. When I read that quote from Wheeler, I was like, all right, so he's at least acknowledging that the EPA is there to help protect human health and the environment. But you got to kind of read between the lines there, don't you?
I think what's going on is, you know, he's trying to frame it in a way that makes it sound like there's been a reallocation of EPA staff to address the pandemic. But in the meantime, while we're doing this over here, we're going to stop monitoring the nation's polluters, the oil refineries, the small manufacturers. And so, like you mentioned, Gina McCarthy, who's now the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, just called him out on it. So this is not a noble sort of thing that the EPA is doing. It's an open license to pollute. And the EPA is clearly taking advantage of the coronavirus pandemic to give polluters a break. This, again, is just part of the sort of litany of deregulatory efforts that are being undertaken by the Department of the Interior, the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, in the midst of this time of crisis.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to journalist Jeremy Miller. So, Jeremy, we've spoken before about the oil industry in California, about how much water fracking takes in the oil and gas industry, and you did a piece that was terrific in exposing the struggle between oil interests and water interests in Kern County, California. We've discussed a little bit of the oil and gas companies, but they're not the only industry that requires a lot of water and is fighting to try to encroach on some of these public lands, are they?
Yeah, absolutely not. The uranium industry has a huge water footprint. And then so a resurgent uranium industry would tax Western waterways to the breaking point. A typical uranium mine will require hundreds, if not thousands, of gallons of water a minute. And when you consider that these mines are in some of the driest parts of the West, I mean, that's a real problem. You create potential conflicts between communities, between users, and it's just a recipe for more resource conflict in the West.
And some of these uranium-rich areas are like Grand Canyon National Park and Bear's Ears. I mean, they're right there, aren't they?
They are.
What kind of excuse do these industries use that we need to go into the Grand Canyon and start mining for uranium? That sounds insane, but that's the world we live in, I guess, these days.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that we're talking about revitalizing the uranium mining and processing industry. But the nuclear industry still has a powerful lobby, and there are still people within positions of power in the U.S. government that believe that this is a way forward, that believe that this is a way to, sometimes it's cynically held up as a way to address climate change crisis. That nuclear energy is often pitched as a carbon-free energy source when in fact it's not. And it's the mining, the milling, the refining of uranium is a hugely energy intensive process. And it's not only energy intensive, but it's hugely landscape scarring.
And it requires tons of water in some of the most water starved parts of the country.
Exactly. And so to think that we should be pursuing uranium mining at the edge of the Grand Canyon and within Bear's Ears National Monument is insanity. but again, is in line with the Trump administration's full-on assault on public lands and environmental law.
So, Jeremy, you also mention in this piece in The Guardian, Trump seizes on pandemic to speed up opening of public lands to industry. You also hit briefly upon the forestry proposals that are happening right now at the BLM and the U.S. Forest Service to destroy large swaths of pinyon and juniper forests across the western United States.
Yeah, this is sort of a more low-key rule change that's going on, but one that's equally destructive. So in March, the BLM attempted to or announced that it would be implementing what's called a categorical exclusion of pinyon and juniper removal projects. And so for your listeners that don't know, pinyon and juniper are these two species of trees that inhabit huge swaths of the West and inhabit some of the driest, most arid, most inhospitable parts of the West. They're not, you know, they're not the sexy redwood forests of California or the big Sitka spruce stands of the Pacific Northwest. These are tough, hardy trees, and sometimes they don't grow more than 10 to 15 feet high in pygmy forests. Nonetheless, they're hugely ecologically important. And what the BLM wants to do is have free rein to remove parcels of up to 10,000 acres of these trees at a time and just clear them out of the way. And the excuse is that the trees are on the march. They're encroaching on sagebrush habitat, right? And the interesting thing, however, is that the BLM line lines up perfectly with the livestock industry's line, which is that the livestock industry doesn't want pinyon juniper forests because they're not as conducive to livestock grazing as sagebrush land is. So the BLM, sort of under the cover of the coronavirus pandemic, has sought this huge categorical exemption to give it the right to go out and just deforest huge swaths of pinyon and juniper forests as a giveaway to the livestock industry. But like I said, a lot of this is being couched now in ecological terms, that it's good for endangered species, such as the sage grouse, that it's reducing fire risk.
Because that's what the ranchers and the lobbyists are most interested in, is protecting the sage grouse, I'm sure.
Right. The sage grouse has sort of emerged as this icon on both sides of preserving sagebrush habitat. Now, there are very valid ecological reasons for wanting to protect sagebrush habitat, but the livestock industry has wielded the sage grouse as a sort of a weapon, a Trojan horse, if you will, to sort of get access, to get its hands on huge parcels of the West to graze cattle on.
I think we have a title for this this week's episode, The Trojan Grouse.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And what you find when you travel in a lot of these areas, particularly in the interior of Nevada and throughout the Great Basin, is you see these massive swaths of area that have been decimated by cheatgrass and crested wheatgrass, these invasive species that have taken over because of unchecked cattle grazing. And basically what you realize when you talk to ecologists is that these areas are not good for anything anymore, even for cattle grazing. So in order for livestock grazing to continue in these very arid and sensitive areas, they've realized that you've got to clear away pinyon and juniper to run cattle.
But as you mentioned in your piece, it's not necessarily the case that cattle can't coexist with trees. It's just easier for these ranchers to sit back and look at a huge plain and count their cattle that way. But once they go into the trees, it gets a little trickier for them. But it's not like the cattle can't coexist with trees, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, I went out with a very astute and longtime pinyon and juniper advocate named Katie Feit, who lives in Boise, Utah. And she knows these forests like no one else. I mean, and she showed me, we traveled to several places in Oregon and Idaho, where you'd go into these old growth stands of juniper trees. And the understory was immaculate. You know, you had dozens of different species of native grasses. And so the on the one hand, you know, the BLM and the ranching industry tries to paint the pinyon and juniper forest as a death trap, as a species on the march. Yeah, it's like it's suicide for any other animal, you know. But you go into these places and you realize they're stabilizing the soil. They provide shade for dozens of understory species of grass, and those species of grass provide habitat for insects and birds, and it's crazy. But the BLM, like I said, has painted these two native species covering hundreds of thousands of acres across the West is somehow on the march, like an invading horde that's encroaching all across the West, and it's just nonsense.
Explain how they got deforested in the first place.
Right. So an environmental historian and biologist that I spoke with named Ron Lanner, who's one of the foremost experts on this subject, told me that what you're seeing is not invasion, it's regeneration. So 100 to 150 years ago, these forests were cleared across the Great Basin, particularly in Nevada, to provide fuel for silver smelting. So huge tracts of forest in the gold rush were cleared, right? And what Ron Lanner told me is that what you're seeing now is just the recolonization of these forests in areas where they traditionally inhabited. That this isn't an invasion, this is regeneration. But the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, has intentionally taken an ahistorical view of these trees and have tried to promote the image that they're suddenly on the advance like an invading army. And it's just not the case. It just doesn't hold up to historical scrutiny.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to journalist Jeremy Miller. So, Jeremy, you started this research before the pandemic. To kind of wrap this up with our earlier discussion on how polluting industries are taking advantage of this pandemic state that we're in, do you have any updates on how the deforestation fight is evolving?
Yeah, well, so in the Guardian article, I mentioned that in March, the BLM announced a proposal that it was seeking what's called a categorical exemption that would allow the BLM to go in and clear huge tracts of forest of up to 10,000 acres apiece without any kind of environmental review, without public comment, would just allow them where they decide that they want to go in and clear a massive swath of trees. They could, you know, if this rule passes, they'll be able to do that. They'll be able to go in and just say, at their discretion, we want to get rid of this tract of forest, and there's very little that the public will be able to do about it. You know, so this is sort of a piecemeal destruction of one of the largest biomes in the country, a species that's just perfectly adapted to these arid, inhospitable conditions. You know, in some sense, I would venture to say it's one of the largest, if not the largest, deforestation campaign in American history that no one's ever heard of, right? We all hear when industry seeks to cut an old growth stand of, say, redwoods in California or an old growth stand of Sitka spruce in the Pacific Northwest, but the pinyon juniper forests of the Great Basin and Intermountain West and Colorado Plateau just don't have the same kind of defenders, don't have the same kind of outcry. And yet they're being cut in massive quantities. And it's an environmental catastrophe.
And the ranching industry is admitting that climate change is one of the reasons for this encroachment, but they're not kind of connecting the dots for any rational thinker who would know that having more trees would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Maybe you can explain a little bit more how they're trying to exploit climate change as an excuse for cutting down trees. It's kind of counterintuitive, isn't mm-hmm. it?
Right. Yeah. When it suits their purposes, they'll even throw out warming temperatures and climate change, although they're generally hesitant to say those words, but they'll talk about regional warming as a catalyst or driver for this encroachment. And that, as you pointed out, forests, as we're coming to realize, are the most potent antidote we have to climate change. That forests are vital in siphoning up excess carbon in the atmosphere. So yeah, it's completely ironic. You know, when it suits their ends, their economic ends, they'll acknowledge climate change, but the remedy is something that's exacerbating the problem.
So, Jeremy, as you were researching this piece, did you get a sense of how the perception of the messaging has changed over the last 40, 50 years when it comes to this sort of land management?
Yeah, I mean, so between, you know, after World War II and the, say, the mid-60s, or even as late as the 80s, the BLM was outspoken in its disdain for these trees. David Tidwell, who was a special assistant to the director of the BLM in 1986, I'll just read this quote from him. He said, "For as long as most of us have been aware of the pinyon juniper woodland type, we have looked upon the aggressive juniper and the scrubby pinyon as weeds in need of eradication." And then he goes on to say, "That's not a goal to be ashamed of. Hundreds of thousands of acres of underproducing rangeland have been transformed into highly productive grazing land." And so during that campaign between 1940 and 1964, more than 3 million acres of pinyon and juniper were cut in an open effort to increase the amount of grazing land. But in the last, say, 20 years, the BLM has done more to cover its tracks. You know, instead of now saying we're out there and doing range improvement, that we're enhancing habitat for endangered species, or we're thinning forests to prevent catastrophic wildfires. So the propaganda has changed. You know, once they were scrubby weeds in need of eradication, and now the trees are a threat somehow to you know, these native trees are a threat to native species in some way. So the transformation of the rhetoric around these trees is just very striking and sort of very obvious. But if you go back and look at the record, the pattern of destruction is the same. It's just the rhetoric that has changed.
Jeremy Miller, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a lot for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Graham Central Station, Bonnie Raitt, and Derek and the Dominoes. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.